Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Imagine a world without the internet, without social media, without AI, without ubiquitous smartphones. Such a world existed only a few decades ago. In that world, there were a few highly trusted news sources. Governments shaped much of the flow of information that reached the public. Investigative journalism challenging official narratives existed, but was relatively rare. Fast forward to 2024. The combination of endless open source information and ubiquitous smart technology allow journalists literally to bypass not only governments, but also large news organizations to debunk propaganda and investigate important stories. That's the world inhabited, to some extent created, by Elliot Higgins. He is an award-winning journalist and founder of the investigative journalism platform Bellingcat that enables citizen journalism on international affairs and much more. Elliot, welcome to New Thinking for a New World.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Let me ask what I think is an obvious starter question. If journalists and news organizations were doing their jobs, objective, thorough, and unbiased investigation and reporting, would Bellingcat exist?
I think so, because we're actually something that is basically emerged from how we've changed the way we access information. So if you look back at 2007 and the launch of the iPhone, how that then led to the spread and use of social media, that's really where Bellingcat has emerged from. It's kind of in parallel to all these more problematic communities that have also emerged thanks to social media. But what's different about Bellingcat is we're really focused on evidence-based investigations. And because there's now a massive amount of information being generated every day from people with smartphones, from different types of online resources, it actually means that, in a sense, this investigation work has been democratized, and that it's not just about having, you know, the right job, being a journalist or working in a certain career. This information is accessible to anyone, as are the tools for doing it. So what we're trying to do at Bellingcat, in part, is teach people how to do this themselves, but also build communities around that so we can investigate a whole range of different topics.
That said, arguably too few, air quotes on, journalism companies, I don't even know, media organizations, let's call them that, media organizations are doing what you do. Is that just because you're newer, so you're able to reimagine how to do this work and you're not as locked into an old model of what is reporting, what is journalism, what is evidence-based, fact-based journalism?
Yeah, I think it's that in part. Really, this way of investigating also emerged not from a kind of academic or professional community, but really from a amateur community. It was very much focused on online communities as well. So actually integrating that into more traditional forms of investigation, be it, you know, the media or human rights focused investigation, took longer, because really the people who are encountering this first in those organizations tended to be the people who are on the internet a lot more. They tended to be the younger people who weren't in the position to actually implement that in their own organizations. So a lot of our work has been really about advocating for open source investigation as a way of investigating things, because it was so new to so many people.
The way you phrase that's terribly important, because you're advocating not for a view of an issue or not for a cause, you're advocating for a way of doing this kind of investigation. One of the problems some of the big news organizations has, precisely because they've replaced traditional journalists with younger internet-based people, is that they moved to what they call advocacy journalism, which has always struck me as an oxymoron. It's either journalism or it's advocacy. And once you put them together, then you're going down a rabbit hole that is really quite dangerous. But you seem both committed to and, in fact, are keeping the two separate. You're in the business of investigating what's out there and trying to understand it and explain it. Is that fair?
I think primarily Bellingcat is an investigative organization. So we're often viewed by people as a journalism organization, but that's because the journalism we produce is maybe the most visible type of work we do. So we have the Bellingcat website, we partner with news organizations, but we also work in a lot of different areas. So we've been doing a large amount of training of other organizations. I think we've trained 8,000 or 9,000 people now in workshops. And these are people from all types of different organizations, you know, everyone from Greenpeace to The Guardian. And it's allowed those organizations to do open source investigation themselves. And particularly since 2022 and the invasion of Ukraine, you've seen more news organizations do open source investigation. And a lot of times it's because we've trained them to do open source investigation in the first place. But we also work in areas of legal accountability using open source evidence, because through our own work, we've seen the value of this evidence in understanding what's happening in conflicts. But there was always questions about how could this actually be used in a legal context? How could, say, the International Criminal Court use this kind of evidence? So we've done a lot of work developing that field as well. We also work in areas of education. So we've developed materials for secondary schools and for universities to educate students around open source investigation techniques. And this isn't to focus on, you know, countering disinformation, which a lot of education efforts are focused on. It's teaching them what I consider increasingly are core skills, that we are surrounded by an information environment that gives us a vast amount of information of varying quality. So how do we figure out what is good quality information and how do we produce good quality information ourselves? So we're really trying to make sure that open source investigation is something that impacts a lot of different fields in a lot of different ways. And really the journalism we produce is just one aspect of that.
One of the key words that you just used was quality. And there have been some perfect examples recently where you pointed out early on in the Gaza war that people were using images from past wars, were using information from past wars and throwing it up on the internet saying, look at, and it didn't matter which side you thought was evil, because they were both, not you, but the person throwing it up was indeed just trying to make a point and was using whatever digital data they found that seemed to make that point.
Yeah, I think there's people like that have different motivations. Some of them are, they just truly believe what they're sharing is real and they don't realize it's being reused from another conflict because they've seen it in a different context. There are some people who are purely doing it as a grift. They're just trying to get followers, gain subscribers, and they just churn out a lot of this content. And that, unfortunately, is something that on platforms like Twitter is effectively rewarded because of the changes that have been made there, that you can buy verified status, you can get yourself to the top of the algorithm, and you can just churn out nonsense and misattributed content and get followers because you're engaging with people emotionally. And the thing is, it's very easy to engage with people on an emotional level. With investigations, it's often a lot harder to engage with people because it's dealing with more complex issues. And actually being able to reach to people on that level requires a lot more work. Whilst if you're just trying to get people engaging with you on an emotional level, you just, you know, find some images that seem upsetting, share it with your followers, and you can churn out 20 or 30 of those in a day. And even if one of those gets, you know, a lot of retweets and the rest don't, you've kind of done your job. You've made a little bit more money.
I want to drill down on an example, but before doing that, ask you about generative AI. It strikes me as potentially an enormous risk, not just to what you're doing, but to society. If ChatGPT 4.5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever, however far they go, can generate the quality of information, conceivably that eventually one could generate an entire narrative, document it down to the in incredible levels of detail, push it out there. How do you keep up with that challenge?
Well, I see it in two ways. One, as evidence. Now, when we do our investigations at Bellingcat, we are considering basically a huge network of information that's interconnected, that each part of it is reviewed and verified. For example, if we have an image, we geolocate it and we can confirm exactly where an image was taken, often down to very, very tiny details. And the problem with AI at the moment, if it creates an image, even of a fairly familiar location, there will still be discrepancies within that image. So, you know, when it comes to more obscure areas that we can still geolocate, it's very, very difficult for AI, if not impossible, to recreate those images. And to do it on a massive scale is very difficult. So in terms of evidence, I'm not worried. In terms of information, it's a nightmare, because I'm not so much worried that it'll convince people of stuff that's not true. It's what gives them a permission structure to believe stuff is fake. So they can say, oh, I don't believe that because it could be AI generated and it doesn't fit my opinion, so I'll dismiss that. So it creates this permission structure to do that. Or the other issue as well is it makes people who are trying to figure out what the truth is and have, you know, are genuinely trying to do that, just give up, because they can't tell if something's an AI-generated image, an AI-generated video. It even affected myself a bit recently, where there's a video I saw of Donald Trump saying something that was kind of his normal ridiculous self, but it had that kind of two-camera, very still motion that a lot of these AI-generated videos have. And I thought, actually, how do I know this video is actually real? Because this is ridiculous. It's exactly the kind of thing he would say, but it's not coming from an account that is, you know, a news site or something that's reliable. So it would require me to go and find this original video to basically fact check this video, when really I'm only in here for a like and a retweet, not like an entire investigation. So, you know, for ordinary people, they can become, you know, they can just detach from these conversations because it's like, well, it's too tough to figure it out. So I'm going to read a book or something, you know, less online, which is good in some ways, but it ends up leaving that kind of discourse space really just dominated by the two sides who are really emotionally engaged with an issue, who don't really care about the facts. They care about winning an argument online. And the kind of center is empty because everyone else has decided it's too hard to figure out what the truth is anyway and have gone off to do something else. And I don't think that's very healthy for discourse, and it's definitely not healthy for democracy.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the day during the Vietnam War when Walter Cronkite turned on the war. And he had just come back from a reporting trip in Vietnam, and he came back and said to a nationwide audience, in a day when the United States had three networks, and you got your news from one of those three, that was it. He said, this war is not winnable. And you could just feel the support for the war, even in places that would otherwise support it, dissipate. So there was a power, there was a trust factor based on individuals, based on news agencies, based on brands, the BBC in the good old days. And that's gone. And it's gone for all the reasons you just described.
And there's this real fragmentation happening in how we consume information. I think this is really one of the big social effects that we've really overlooked. And I'm often dealing a lot with people who work in the counter-disinformation area. And that's so often seen as something that's an outside actor that's doing something to us. And it's usually Russia they point the finger at, and, you know, China to a slightly lesser extent. Really what's happening is a big social shift in how we consume information and interact with it. And if you actually look at where disinformation often comes from, it's from online communities who aren't being influenced by Russia, even though they may be pro-Russian. They are more influenced by the fact that they feel a very big sense of betrayal from a source of authority. And they find like-minded people online who have that same sense of betrayal, and they reinforce each other's sense of betrayal until they see the world through a very kind of twisted lens. And often these betrayals are rooted in something truthful. So the invasion of Iraq in 2003 is often cited by people who deny the use of chemical weapons in Syria, because from their perspective, that this is just a repeat of what happened with Iraq. It's America, American imperialists, yet again, trying to invade a country for its oil, and they're making up stories about chemical weapons. And anyone who's claiming there was chemical weapons, be it the OPCW, Bellingcat, Human Rights Watch, are part of that entire system that's actually trying to deceive the public, because they know that they're the truth seekers and the truth is on their side. So when they look at this topic themselves, they are seeing it through this very particular lens. And this can affect people on a whole range of different topics. And it doesn't have to be huge global topics. It can be stuff that's, you know, COVID's obviously a big example of this, but you have flat earthers who are impacted with this, people who have very specific interests who are also affected by this. But when you actually look at the root cause of why all these communities come together, it's that sense of betrayal, that sense of distrust that's really, really important. And that's why trust is a really, really big part of this, but also community is a really big part of this, both in how these communities form that spread disinformation, thinking they're truth seekers, but also how we have to counter these issues as well. We need counter communities, in a sense, to kind of push back against this kind of disinformation and these communities.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
The irony of what you just said is that people lose trust in big things and need to trust something. They trust whatever this community is that they've latched onto. And so they've literally shifted the focus of trust. Yes, I trust you because I've spent time with you online or maybe even in person. How revolutionary is that idea? So I have to trust something, and I am able to recalibrate that trust, but in a way that doesn't add up.
And in a sense, they're trusting their own sense of betrayal. They know they've been betrayed. The people they've been betrayed by are the bad guys, and they find other people who've had that same experience. So everyone's reinforcing each other's sense of betrayal and that distrust. And you see this happening on so many different communities. I mean, I've worked on, you know, chemical weapon use in Syria, MH17 being shot down in eastern Ukraine, the Flat Earth movement, COVID, and all kinds of little fringe groups. And if you really break down, you know, the root of why they're kind of, they have these opinions, it's always, you know, I've been betrayed. So, you know, a lot of these betrayals are legitimate. They do come from governments. So the problem we have is, are we ever going to be in a situation where the governments of the world tell the truth all the times, where occasionally they don't do things that are so terrible that it causes these kind of waves of betrayal passing through society? No, I don't think so. So how do we then address that issue?
They never have, they never will. That's not the nature of government or of mankind.
And then when you have large media organizations who people start feeling are complicit in this, even when often they're not, it's just the kind of framing they have. It's like, oh, the BBC are saying Assad used chemical weapons, and therefore that means they're part of this government conspiracy against Syria because it's Iraq all over again. Then they start being able to kind of broaden the kind of network of conspiracy they see, because they know they're right. And therefore, if someone's telling them they're wrong, then that person must be part of the conspiracy effectively. So our approach is more about, okay, how do we educate people? How do we stop people actually becoming parts of these communities? Because once they reach those bubbles and these communities, it's very hard to get them out of there, because all the fact checks in the world don't matter, because those fact checks are being done by people that they don't trust. So we have an approach at Bellingcat where we look at building school curriculum. We've started early work on that, and we're trying to build a curriculum for secondary education where we aren't just teaching young people about this is what disinformation is, but we're talking to them about actually how do you find the truth when you're in a media environment that is no longer this gatekeep top-down model. It's this peer-to-peer environment where you're 11-year-olds, you've got a smartphone, you're on social media, and that's where you get your information. So how do you decide what's good information? How do you actually dig deeper than just listening to what someone's telling you on TikTok? How do you actually find the truth? And more importantly, if you find the truth, how do you actually have an impact with that truth? Because the worst thing we could do is to teach young people that the truth matters, show them how to find the truth, and then nothing changes. Because then all we're doing is reinforcing this idea that they can't trust the government, the media. So we're also working on with universities to hopefully in the long term build investigative hubs at universities that will then connect to local schools, NGOs, local media to work on issues that affect them directly. And not everything has to be about chemical weapons attacks and war. It can be, you know, why are the bins not being emptied on my street before they're overflowing? Or why are there so many high-speed police chases on my local streets? And teaching them the very simple skills, things like freedom of information requests, you know, how do you actually make a case? How do you gather evidence? And making that, you know, something that's makes them feel more included in society as well. Because if there's one thing young people feel nowadays, is they really don't feel served by society, because they see a society built around models that, again, are focused on this top-down gatekeep model. where the government, the media, doesn't really serve their interests, whilst they can find plenty of communities online that do serve their interests and they do reinforce their beliefs. But we aren't teaching them really how to make value judgments on those communities to actually say, okay, how do you know this person who can present themselves very well on social media is actually telling you the truth or knows what they're talking about?
I'd love to pursue that because I'd make the case that the first part of what you described has happened before. That is to say, people lost trust in the big organizations that formed what you're supposed to believe. I'm thinking about the 60s and 70s, Vietnam, what was going on in Europe. But what's different is social media, the internet, the tools that have that allow those communities to form spontaneously without borders and to develop their own dynamics and capacities. But what I'd like to do is shift to an example of some of the work Bellingcat is doing. And I was quite taken with a story you published recently on the Gaza war, and a unit of the IDF who's in the business, was in the business of blowing up things. The great quote, I think it's from the Scripps journalist with whom you partnered, quote, "I think we are the unit, at least until we left, that blew up the most houses in Gaza." And the nose count was 84 days, 49 tunnels, 662 buildings. What's fascinating about the story is maps, videos, interviews, really gritty, down-to-earth concrete detail that make it not only credible, but that almost unassailable. How do you do that kind of work? How did your team do that particular investigation?
With Israel and Gaza, what you find is among Palestinians is there's, because of the limits on things like internet access, there's not a huge amount of information that comes through the kind of sources we often rely on, which are social media posts. But you do actually find on the side of the Israelis that there are a lot of social media posts because these soldiers are filming what they're doing and sharing them online. And some of the stuff they're sharing is very questionable, to say the least, but they feel justified in sharing it because, you know, in their minds, what they're doing is right. They're fighting against an enemy. They feel they're supported by the Israeli people. But what it actually reveals is patterns of behavior that can be investigated. So we encountered more and more videos that showed these videos where really, if you watch the videos that are connected to this article, they're not just filming stuff blowing up. They're kind of almost making a show of it, a kind of performance for, you know, Instagram posts and stuff like that. So we started documenting these and trying to figure out who these people were, what units they were part of. And we tracked one unit in particular and their activities through Gaza. And first, we wanted to kind of look at what that individual unit was doing, where they were operating, what buildings they were destroying, but then kind of zoom out a bit and look at kind of the more broader level of destruction of property across Gaza. So there we brought in some other techniques. There was a method that's being used to combining different types of satellite imagery and satellite data to actually analyze damage and destruction of buildings. And so we could see the scale that was happening. We could use the kind of visual imagery to see, for example, they're building a wall between Gaza City and the Israeli border to the coast, that they've been clearing, completely flattening everything within a kilometer of that wall. And you can see that damage on satellite imagery. You can see olive groves destroyed, buildings flattened. And this is not because they are a military target. It's because they're within a zone that will be basically a no man's land when they actually have this wall up and running. So they're clearing that out. So by combining these different types of sources, the personal social media posts of Israeli soldiers, different types of satellite map imagery analysis, actual kind of quite new techniques in analyzing this kind of imagery, you can get a kind of multifaceted view on a topic. And a lot of the work we're doing now is really focused on legal accountability. A lot of that work started first with Saudi airstrikes in Yemen and looking at the civilian harm there. For the last 2 years, we've been doing work on justice and accountability that focuses on the conflict in Ukraine. That's specifically intended as a process to create evidence for use in places like the International Criminal Court. So this evidence that you gather as part of these investigations can be used for more than just reporting. It can actually be evidence of criminal activity. And certainly with the recent announcement from the ICC about the request for the arrest warrants, I think this information is becoming more and more relevant. And this is a really, really huge shift, because even 5 years ago, it was still quite a new theory that this stuff could be used as evidence in court. And there was always a very long debate about what could and couldn't be used. It was so new to say that you don't have the witness, you don't have the original media, you have social media posts. How do you actually turn that into evidence? That's something we've worked on as an organization to develop. And we're in a really good position to use that now. And as there's more conflicts, you know, spreading across the world, not just Israel and Gaza, but, you know, stuff that's happening in Sudan and elsewhere, this open source evidence becomes more and more valuable, because often there's so much of it.
Let me pull on one thread. You've mentioned three spaces: Gaza, Ukraine, Yemen. Clearly, in each case, one side it generates more of the kind of data that you can use to build these very detailed fact-based stories. There, as you said, there's not much in the way of internet access in Palestine, in Gaza, ditto among the Houthis, etc. Does that impart a kind of bias, not in your reporting, but in what you can't report? So part of the story is much more nuanced than the other part of the story can be. And the ICJ investigation is interesting because it is aimed at both the Hamas leadership and the Israeli leadership. So there's a real need for that kind of data.
Yeah, it's difficult because, yeah, as you're saying, it creates this kind of bias that you see where, if it wasn't for those Israeli soldiers who were sharing all those videos, we wouldn't have been able to do the investigations. It's similar actually in 2014 when we were investigating MH17. We found a massive amount of information about the Russian military because soldiers in the Russian military were using social media to connect all their friends who happened to be soldiers who were all posting images of their service. And some of that what we could use to show that Russian troops were inside Ukraine, because they take a photo in Russia and then one in Ukraine, and it was pretty obvious what was going on. So inherently, you do have this bias. But I think it's also important to consider that open source investigation is not meant to replace other forms of investigation. It's just additional information that you can get from these fresh sets of sources. And there's a huge amount that can be discovered. Really, we've barely scratched the surface of what could be done with this, especially in regards to legal accountability. And this is especially why we try and train as many people as possible in doing this work, because Bellingcat is still, you know, a small organization. We have just under 40 staff, and that means we can't investigate every single thing in the world, but we can equip other people to do that. So a really big part of what we're doing is not just the training, but also building communities where we can actually have people who are digging into stuff that interests them, and then we can kind of pick that up and turn it into articles and reporting. So what we've decided to do is, rather than trying to do everything ourselves, is to kind of democratize that, share those ideas, those methodologies, and give other people the opportunity to do this kind of work without the direct intervention of Bellingcat.
I want to end with the quality question again, because having read a lot of the Bellingcat reporting, you clearly do care about quality. There is an enormous effort, obvious effort, to understand the details, to reject things that don't fit a narrative. You're looking for fact-based evidence. I can easily imagine that other organizations, other communities, to use your term, might not be as motivated as you are. So how do you impart not just the tools to do this, but the need for quality, the real deep commitment to actually finding evidence, not just proving a point?
So kind of in the more broader community of open source investigators, we generally are quite critical of each other's work if we spot mistakes in it. So I remember there was a report from one of the UN bodies that used satellite imagery analysis of aircraft on an airstrip that got torn apart by the rest of the open source community because they misidentified the aircraft, and everyone made a kind of big noise about that. And that's the thing. If you're doing proper open source investigation, you're providing the sources you're using. So it leaves you wide open to attacks if you make things wrong. And that, in a way, is kind of makes it self-policing. One of the communities we've set up, though, is a Discord community. We have about 28,000 members on that community. It's our Bellingcat Discord. Anyone can join that, and we keep it quite well moderated because we want it to be a place where it's about discussing facts and evidence, not people's opinions and their emotional feelings about a topic, because that just makes things go off track. But there, we have a process where people on that community might start digging into something, and because they've learned from Bellingcat these different techniques, they can start applying to it. But we'll observe that work, and then if it gets to a point where we think there's a possible publication, that can then be brought kind of into our editorial process and developed with the people in the community into a full story, but using the fact-checking and editorial standards of Bellingcat. So we kind of lift up the standards of the quality of work, and then we publish it and push it back out to the community again, who then can actually build on the information because we have access to things like satellite data that they might not have access to. So we try and have not just this kind of, we bring stuff in, push it out, and then it's done, but this kind of cycle of involvement with our community. And we're making sure that they're getting credit for their work because, you know, they've done the kind of main kind of body of the work, but we're making sure it also has the high quality of standards we would expect if it's actually going to be published work. So it's a lot of it is kind of managing those workflows, you know, taking something from the more kind of chaotic parts of the online communities and then putting it into a process that allows us to re-verify that work and put it into a format that is more reliable, more accessible, and often easier to read for lots of people.
When I started thinking about this conversation, I was thinking about traditional investigative journalists, the old private eye in the UK, more recently Panama Papers, back to the day, the Watergate investigations. Most of those, although not Panama Papers as much, were jealously guarded by the people working on them. What you've just described is a very different model, that it is much more about, as one would expect for the internet, much more about collaboration and sharing and trying to make each other better. And I can only end by saying, I hope, Elliot, that you're able to accomplish that, because both the need for that kind of work and the potential for that kind of work, again, in a world that I worry about, the ChatGPT-10 world, is even greater than it has been. So thanks for this conversation. Very much appreciated it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.